This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster human unity. We present views and experiences of the world's religions and spiritual belief systems from a philosophical and historical perspective to be an on-air classroom, helping the audience gain insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. Today we have a very special show ahead of us, so I won't hesitate to introduce our guest. Dr. Asma Afsaruddin is professor of Islamic Studies in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures and adjunct faculty in Religious Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington. She received her Ph.D. in Islamic Studies from Johns Hopkins University in 1993 and previously taught at Johns Hopkins, Harvard, and Notre Dame Universities. She is the author and editor of four books, including The First Muslims, History and Memory, which we hope to discuss at length today, also Excellence and Precedence, Medieval Islamic Discourse on Legitimate Leadership, and Hermeneutics and Honor, Negotiating Women's Public Space in Islamicate Societies. She has also written over 50 scholarly articles and popular essays on pluralism in Islamic thought, interfaith relations, reconciliation, and violence in Islamic legal and exegetical works, and gender issues. Professor Afsaruddin lectures widely on various aspects of pre-modern and modern Islamic thought in the U.S., Europe, and the Middle East, and frequently consults with governmental and non-governmental organizations. She is currently the chair of the board of directors of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy and on the advisory board of the U.S. Muslim World Initiative at the United States Institute of Peace. A recipient of grants from the Guggenheim Foundation and the Carnegie Corporation, Professor Afsaruddin is completing a book-length manuscript on jihad and martyrdom in Islamic thought and practice to be published by Oxford University Press. Doctor, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, this is such a broad, you know, area we'll be discussing today, but I was hoping before we get into discussing the first Muslims, that you might share a little bit of your own journey first as a scholar of your own faith and also, of course, as a woman in this scenario as well.
Right. Well, I mean, I was drawn to my current research areas and interest in teaching and so forth, of course, because of my own background as a Muslim. And as someone who's interested in exploring her own background more deeply, I first started studying Arabic as an undergraduate, and I went to Oberlin College in Ohio, and that's when I really fell in love with the language. And at that time, I had thought I would be specializing in my graduate work on the contemporary Middle East, and then I realized that one cannot understand the modern period very well without understanding the deeper historical roots of many of the issues that we deal with as students of Islam. And that's when I decided that my whole trajectory had to change, and I really wanted to start in the period when Islam was born and the transformations that it underwent from the 7th century till the present period. I mean, that's, of course, a tall order, and I certainly don't claim, and I don't think anyone does, that they understand each of these periods very well. But my purpose was to draw these connections, though, between the past and the present, make the present speak to the past and vice versa, and not speak about a number of critical issues devoid of a historical context. I think that's where most misunderstandings arise. And I'm very concerned about some of the polemical rhetoric that has grown up on many sides concerning religious issues, concerning relationships between Muslims and non-Muslims, and that we have the resources within our own religious traditions to actually carve out a space for dialogue, for mutual respect, and for mutual transformation through these respectful conversations with one another. And I really believe in this purpose more so than ever, particularly because I can see almost tangible results from taking part in such dialogues, taking part in such conversations, hopefully the kind that we're going to engage in today as well.
Yes, I relate very much to what you're sharing. In many ways, in order to pave a road ahead, we do need to first visit where we've been. And in this age, especially where information is flying so quickly now due to technology, it very often has no context.
That's right.
And information without context won't really lead us to wisdom or wise interpretation or choices. And can foster. It can even help to foster prejudice. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, to gain a context, I certainly relate even from my own tradition and background as a theologian in the Christian faith that even within our own faith and all the different denominations, we need to look at our roots a little more to figure out how to move ahead together. A little better. So imagine then going in terms of interreligious dynamics, you know, how much we can bring to bear if we have a stronger foundation of this knowledge. And I'm very interested in hearing about the book that you've written, The First Muslims. Essentially, you drew from original texts and reconstructed what that community looked like. Can you share with us today what did the original Muslim community look like?
Well, one of the main purposes of writing this book is to show that there were many diverse strands within that early Muslim community, and that early Muslims were not hesitant about offering multiple interpretations of sacred texts. So we find that from after the time of the Prophet Muhammad, the companions, as we call them, the closest associates and disciples of the Prophet, often had varying interpretations of key verses in the Quran, for example, or of what a particular saying of the Prophet meant in their own circumstances. But they learned to talk to one another in an atmosphere of mutual respect and out of profound reverence for the learning and the diverse perspectives that they brought to the table, so to speak. So we can point back to this early community where we had genuine pluralism, pluralism with regard to views, pluralism with regard to relations with non-Muslims, particularly the Jews and Christians who have lived among Muslims from the very beginning. With regard to relations between men and women, what I was deeply struck by was the fact that in the earliest sources we have, biographical and historical sources, the foundation of relations among human beings was one based on equality and justice. And this was deeply manifested in relations between men and women. Muslim women from the get-go participated robustly, actively, visibly, publicly in affairs of the community. And we have these historical records to prove that that was indeed the case. They distinguished themselves as educators, as leaders within the community, and they had the rights equal to that of men to make their opinions known in public. So it made me realize, when you dig that far deeply into these foundational texts, that some of the conventional wisdom that has grown up about Islamic teachings particularly among Muslims, leave alone those who are outside the tradition, but particularly among Muslims and in the contemporary period, are oftentimes at complete variance with what we know to be to have actually happened in the early period, again, firmly grounded in these foundational texts. So I was very concerned about presenting these findings to a broad audience. Up until this time, my scholarship had focused on writing rather abstruse works targeting, you know, my own cohorts in the field, which means, you know, maybe a handful of scholars at best would be interested in what I had to write. But I wanted to write in an accessible and engaging manner to present some of these findings to a broader reading public, both Muslim and non-Muslim, and anyone who's interested, to show the possibilities that exist for contemporary Muslims of crafting an understanding of their faith that is perfectly at home in a world that is growing increasingly pluralistic, in a globalizing world, where the traditional boundaries among religious communities, among nations, are rather dissolving, and that Islam has much to contribute to this universal discourse about equality, about justice, about mercy, that these are essential principles within the faith tradition, and that Muslims should concentrate on foregrounding these basic principles, particularly in the face of extremism, particularly in the face of the fact that it's the extremist views that we hear about, particularly in the American media. And therefore, as a way of undermining the legitimacy of these extremist discourses and to make this knowledge far more widely available, I responded very positively to the request by One World Publications to write a book of this sort. I have to say I was a little intimidated at first because typically we're not trained to write in an accessible manner, I actually found it to be much more challenging, but ultimately much more rewarding because I've heard from so many different people who said that, you know, it opened a window into the early history of Islam and made it relevant to the contemporary period. So if people who read my book can at least get that much out of it, I will feel that, you know, my efforts were really worth it and that I've accomplished my goal in a modest manner and that I've hopefully contributed to a better public understanding of, you know, the diversity, the internal pluralism of the Islamic tradition.
Yes, and I think it's important, as you say, that we are able to apply our history to our modern world without feeling, you know, afraid that we're somehow going to destroy the core of the faith, which we don't need to do. I find that the core, for example, in my own background, the core of my faith as a Christian, I would, I guess, describe as somewhat conservative, but I enjoy living it out and seeing, as you would call it, what kind of pluralistic way we can live this out in a modern, you know, high-tech, forward-looking world, I find. Now, you mentioned you were concerned about, you had some concern about writing this. What was your concern?
Oh, well, writing in a way that would be considered accessible to a broad reading public. What I was trying to say is that we're not usually trained to write that way. So that was a particular concern of mine, if I could actually rise to this challenge, because I had not previously engaged in this kind of work. But now it's looking back in hindsight, I think it's probably one of the most inspirational and rewarding things that I ever did, because it was such an important educational process for me. It made me look into sources that I perhaps otherwise would not have looked into, and allowed myself to retrieve this kind of information that, unless you know Arabic and you're able to read these medieval texts, is not very easy to come by. So it's very important for me to put all this, all these findings, into a language that I hope other people will find accessible. I mean, Carol, I'm hoping that perhaps you can tell me if, you know, when you read this work, this was something that perhaps came across clearly and wasn't jargon-ridden, or, you know, masked in rather obscure prose that I think turns many people off.
No, no, I understand what you mean. And it also sounds as though your studies, your research brought you a, sort of a pleasant surprise and a joyful one about your own heritage, your own spiritual background.
Yes, yes. And as I said, I discovered many things that I didn't know. And so this is a line of inquiry that I want to pursue further in the future as well. I am currently writing a book on, you know, the various meanings of jihad, particularly in the early period,
yeah.
and how those meanings have been co-opted and transformed by different groups
yeah.
through different periods in history. So, again, I'm kind of applying the same kind of historical, source-critical line of inquiry to my current work as well. So I think it's really helped me to see the value of this kind of historical research.
And I'd like to get to that subject of
okay.
jihad, as you just mentioned, in a moment.
Sure.
But before we leave the early Muslim community, you know, the early Christian community, we're all very aware of, and it's all written in English very clearly for us. In
mm-hmm.
our, we don't have the excuse of an obscure text for our own advantage here.
Right.
And we know that the early community began in a similar fashion. Very pluralistic, male and female equality,
mm-hmm.
Everyone sharing all things together as one community. And I have my theories about when that changed and evolved into what we see now, more
mm-hmm.
as, you know, the diverse Christian churches. And for me, you know, a lot of times I find as soon as you move into a building and you have a church roof that needs fixing, things start to become a little more about not offending the congregation with your sermon, because you know we're counting on the collection plate and that sort of thing. For me, that can just
yeah.
stifle the spiritual
yeah.
growth of a community. Whereas in the beginning, it began in people's houses and moved around among people's houses, much as the Amish do today. And it was just a very, very simple. Faith, a very, you know, exuberant faith of the newly, you know, converted and with hearts on fire for God, basically.
Yeah.
What can you think of along the lines? How did it change from there, from the earliest experience? What would happen, or what did happen to your mind that might have changed the course of the development of the Muslim faith in the world?
Right. Well, first of all, I don't think, you know, people have lost complete awareness of the actual roots of Islam. But people's priorities change. And as Islam became organized into a world religion and became the religion of a vastly and fast expanding empire, that's when we see the changes coming in. It started under the Umayyads. This was the first political dynasty in Islam that started in the late 7th century, continued through the Abbasids, the next very successful dynasty. And what we have is a sense of political realism setting in, that there are more worldly, pragmatic considerations coming in, something that you alluded to also in the development of Christian thought, and you talked about the collection plate. Well, yes, very mundane concerns about material well-being, about political expansion of the territories under your control. All those considerations, I think, over time took their toll. Islamic society started becoming much more patriarchal, much more hierarchical, and some of that is also due to changes coming in from the outside. Persian thought, for example, becomes very prominent in the 8th century under the Abbasids. And so they're bringing in their perspectives on things, and Persian society was very hierarchical. They were very concerned about the social status of individuals. Similarly with the translation of classical Greek works, and again, of course, classical Greece was very much a society that was conscious of social rank and very patriarchal. It's really only the rich men, the wealthy males who exercise political power, and women were always considered marginal to such societies. Many of these attitudes started seeping in. And when we do a critical survey of the works written in these periods, we can start tracing these transformations through the works that were written, that were composed in this period. So we have a fairly good idea of why some of these fundamental social and political and historical transformations were taking place in response to the change in the overall circumstances of the community. It does not mean that these changes were accepted wholesale, in one fell swoop. They were always contested. And I tried to give a sense of those contestations throughout time in my book, The First Muslims, and particularly in my current book on jihad. I try to resurrect these voices that were ultimately marginalized, the voices of the pious dissenting factions, the voices of women, the voices of those who were left out of the power circles, the voices of jurists who were not affiliated with the ruling elite. Those voices have to be brought back into the mainstream, because ultimately the works that we read are often composed by the official circles. You know, what we're left with are often the official kind of doctored accounts of what was going on in these periods. And I think it is the job of historians to provide a much more holistic view by digging even deeper and looking to the lives who tend to fall through the cracks and bring them back from the margins into the very center of these historical discourses.
Yes, so, and in your case, restoring that pluralism and the equality between the women and men that was there in the beginning.
Yes, absolutely. And also the very tolerant and accommodationist views that existed with regard to Jewish and Christian communities and eventually other non-Muslim communities as well. I mean, we see that very early in the sources that Jews and Christians were considered to be equal members of the communities, and they were allowed to practice their faith unmolested and so forth. But those attitudes did not always continue. They kind of ebbed and flowed in relation to, again, changing political circumstances. We need to be aware of these diverse trends that existed in these early communities and the reasons why these attitudes began to change, and that it was almost always in response to external historical circumstances. We need to historicize these discourses and retrieve those multiple voices that were often dissenting voices on the margins. So again, to present a holistic picture of what was going on in the past, because it's not just an academic concern. When it comes to Islam, these are issues that are very, very relevant in the contemporary period. And it's a very important way of challenging monolithic, extremist discourses.
In any religion,
Yes, and this is true of any religious tradition. But I think it is particularly urgent within Muslim communities today.
This is a fascinating discussion. I'm going to take a short break now, and when we come back, I'd like to discuss more about the original meaning of the word jihad and your other book that you're working on. But first, we like to showcase new and interesting music on Godspeed, and this piece is called Dunia by Africa Freedom.
Yeah.
Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck, and we're talking today with Islamic scholar and author, Dr. Asma Afsaruddin. Doctor, can we explore a little bit more of where we left off there when you were bringing up jihad and the new book that you're working on? I looked into your work as well and was surprised to learn the actual or original meaning of the word, and was wondering if you could share that with us.
Sure, yes. The actual basic meaning of jihad is struggle, and the full expression, the full Arabic expression that occurs in the Quran is al-jihad fi sabilillah. That means struggling for the sake of God. Now, struggle or striving for the sake of God can assume many different forms and shapes. One's basic struggle to be a good person, to live an upright life in this world, to interact with one's neighbor and do good to one's neighbor, all that is included under the rubric of jihad. Now, the word jihad, of course, has become extremely politicized and vulgarized, I would say, particularly in the popular media. And we only hear about the word in the context of fighting, violence.
It's become, in other words, again, a tool of fear, I believe.
Yes, it has. It has, mainly because we hear only extremist voices and militant voices who use this term. And as many people have said, and I agree with them, they have really hijacked the term jihad for their own nefarious purposes. And I, for one, never use the word jihadists in relation to them, because I will not concede their right to use this term for their violent and militant enterprises. Jihad has a very strong spiritual, social reformist aspect to it. It always begins with the individual. There is a powerful verse in the Quran which says that God will not change the circumstances of a group of people unless they change what is in themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's where our fundamental human struggle begins. And, of course, this is a concept that resonates with many religious traditions. And it's interesting, in Arabic translations of the New Testament, the struggle of Christ on earth is actually described as a jihad. And I often point that out to my students, particularly in an interfaith context, that, you know, here we have the most universal definition of jihad. Ultimately, the basic definition is the struggle to be a good person, to do good to others, and to lead an upright life in accordance with, you know, universal values of righteous conduct. That is the definition of jihad. And we have that expressed in many different ways within the Islamic tradition. That is the primary meaning within the Quran. The Quran does allow armed combat in defense only, when jihad, one aspect of jihad can be the military aspect. But in that case, there are many strict regulations governing the use of force. One would have to be under attack. In other words, it's the opposite side that must initiate the attack, to which Muslims then have a right to respond militarily. And during the course of the military jihad, Muslim combatants have to observe very strict rules of conduct. They cannot target civilians. Only combatants can be fought. And by civilians, we mean women, children, the elderly, or men who don't bear arms, religious people, priests, clerics, etc., are clearly exempted from attack, those who are ill, and so forth and so forth. Again, this is an aspect that's not very well known to a lot of people. In that sense, the military jihad then does become the equivalent of the notion of just war within the Christian tradition. You know, where, again, very strict restrictions are placed on the behavior of military combatants when they're targeting the enemy. So these are the kind of points that I want to raise in my book. Again, provide a wide-ranging historical overview of what this concept has meant in different time periods to different groups of people, and ending with the contemporary period to show how divergent some of these popular understandings of jihad as expressed in extremist discourses have become from mainstream classical understandings of jihad as expressed in reliable historical and ethical texts. So I'm very much following, again, a similar line of inquiry where I want to treat this concept holistically, not atomistically, and providing the historical context for a number of these discourses that have grown up.
Yes,
so
and I
hope that's helpful.
Yes, no, and I understand the more generalized concept of jihad as a spiritual principle of mm-hmm. struggle and growth and development.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar way, words like obedience, which is of course a spiritual principle in many religions, that word got hijacked as well in our current culture as meaning something negative, as though you're same as a submission or under someone's thumb or not having your own identity or losing your identity, when the word obedience actually means to listen at its core, and is a very important principle in relationships, you know, not only within the home, but in the community and in the world at large. So helping to reach back and bring these principles back, you know, into place, in their rightful place, of course, is helpful in the modern world where things are very, very skewed these days, and very inflammatory, and almost seem to be used to inflame. And people are reactionary. People are not mulling things or reflecting very much. There's a lot going on with opinion, not necessarily much going on from the heart, and from what we know is true.
Yes, I agree. I think there is a rather modern impatience with complexity and ambiguity. There is a tendency to simplify everything. Again, I think you see that in many religious traditions where people often want clear answers, black and white answers. And one does a great disservice to any religious tradition by distilling its complex heritage into pat answers that, as you said, can be used to inflame the passions of people or to mislead people into thinking that there is only one kind of monolithic essence to every religious tradition, when in fact all these religious traditions are internally diverse and open to so many different interpretations that can coexist in harmony. We should not be afraid of difference. And it's something actually I like telling my fellow Muslims over and over again. The Quran actually says in a number of key passages that God deliberately created humans in many different forms and in different nations and tribes so that they may learn from one another.
Mm.
That this is actually meant to enhance our spiritual richness and our knowledge and add to the meanings of our lives.
And this is why we're doing this program.
There's such a lack of a balanced
mm-hmm. view out there.
Yeah.
It's startling when you start to unearth all the nuance that you're discussing
mm-hmm.
right now. We're depriving ourselves of the deep nuance. And then so much of the beauty happens in the nuance within our own experience and our own faith, as well as how we then engage and encounter another faith. It's so much in the nuance, and certainly not in black and white pat answers to anything. Last week we were sharing some poetry of Rumi on the air, and you know, there's had a sort of pleasant surprise and joyful surprise to find this mystic, you know, Sufi mystic writing mm-hmm. centuries ago. And in his poetry, he is writing about Muhammad, and he's writing about Moses, and he's writing
mm-hmm.
about Jesus, and they are all in there, and it's so mm-hmm. beautiful. It's startling. But we've forgotten that, or we haven't let that weigh in very much on our, you know, in these discussions and in our evolution. So we are trying to, you know, work to, as you said, to make this a more holistic, you know, picture. I would like to discuss, first of all, I guess you're also focusing on gender issues in
mm-hmm.
Islam.
Yes,
and then also, if you have a moment, something of a little more personal nature, if you would like to share something in terms of the living out of the faith, a particular
mm-hmm.
ceremony or celebration or something you enjoy, and what gives you strength and peace, I'd love to hear something about that as well.
You want me to do both? Talk about the gender issue and also...
Yeah.
There's
time.
maybe I can combine the two.
Okay.
As a Muslim woman, actually, I find Islam very empowering. And I know that Christian women, Jewish women, and women from other religious traditions are drawing a similar kind of empowerment from their own religious traditions, because I actually like to read the writings of other women writers, women authors, and many of them call themselves feminists. I didn't think it matters what they call themselves, who are similarly drawing inspiration from their own faith and from the teachings of their own religious traditions. In my case, it's very clear, especially from reading the Quran, that the Quran accords complete equality to men and women. The men and women have equal rights to one another. If you could just bear with me for a minute,
I will take all the time we need.
I wanted to find this particular passage, which clearly states in the Quran that men and women are equal. I'll keep looking at it and read it to you when I find it. But it basically says that whatever women and men do in terms of righteous actions, none of that will go to waste, and that they're equally valorized.
Mm.
Women have the right to education in Islam, and from the very beginning, women have served as scholars. People forget that well-known male jurists like Ash-Shafi'i studied with women scholars. Their names are not always mentioned, of course, in sort of the master narratives that have grown up.
Right.
about medieval Islamic scholarship, but they're there. They're there. Mm. And those who can read the sources for themselves can easily find, these references to women scholars.
Mm.
Women were given specific legal rights. They can hold property in their own names, even after getting married. Mm. And not her husband has no right to that property. It's entirely hers to dispose of as she wills. Therefore, we often have a number of women benefactors of charitable institutions in the medieval period. And the reason we know that is because the names are mentioned in the documents that establish these charitable endowments. So schools and hospitals, other public institutions were founded by these women, by these wealthy women, who, again, could, dispose of their wealth as they saw fit. So these are very important historical examples, bring forth, to emphasize in the contemporary period, especially since a number of Muslim-majority countries have seen fit to restrict the rights of women. And I'm thinking primarily of a country like Saudi Arabia,
yes,
and Iran to a certain extent. Although women, and what we don't often hear about is that women are often fighting back. In Iran in particular, because you have such highly educated women, despite the fact that the government is often sharply cracked down on women's organizations and women's journals and so forth. Women are extremely active in a number of different spheres in Iranian society. There are a number of women parliamentarians currently in Iran. And even though some of these very progressive journals are shut down by the government from time to time, it hasn't stopped women from getting their voices out there through very, many different means. Again,
sure.
those are the voices that we often don't hear about in the popular media. So we often have a very skewed notion of what's going on. But women have been making a lot of progress. And oftentimes, they will, if not almost all the time, they will argue for their rights on the basis of Islamic law. Because they will say, it is Islamic law itself that has given us these rights. And therefore, no human being has the right to take these rights away from us. I don't know if you remember this anecdote in my book, The First Muslims, where I talk about the second caliph, the second ruler after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, who had declared in the mosque in Medina that he was going to cap the amount of gift that a woman was entitled to after marriage. And an elderly woman spoke up in the mosque and said, "Omar," addressing the caliph directly, "you have absolutely no right to take away what God himself has given us." And Omar was chastised by this, and in an unexpected show of humility, I would say, he said publicly that he was wrong and this woman was right. And that's a very important anecdote because it shows that on the basis of Islamic teachings, on the basis of what the Quran allows Muslim women, it is possible for women to assert their rights. And increasingly, this is becoming the basis of what people are calling Islamic feminism. And I really do think that these are the kinds of movements that are based on Islamic principles that have that are most likely to succeed in the future because such arguments resonate with the majority of Muslim populations in the world, mainly because many Muslims are still very observant and they will respond to legitimate calls for self-empowerment and ultimately to calls for justice in the name of Islamic teachings. So I find this to be a very promising trajectory. And as a Muslim woman myself, I find this to be an extremely empowering way of asserting myself as an equal participant in the shaping of these discourses and challenging the kind of the violations that have occurred over time in the name of Islam, in patriarchal societies, that needs to be challenged in this way, in this very coherent way. That, again, as I said, is a primary concern of mine. Other practices that I find very ennobling and spiritually uplifting within Islam is the stress on prayer and charity. Again, these are universal principles and resonate with, you know, a number of other religious groups as well. But, you know, Muslims are required to pray five times a day. So there is a constant emphasis throughout the day on communion with God. And when one gets into the habit of doing that, one looks forward to this opportunity, to this quiet time during the day, to this kind of downtime during the day, which reminds you of our priorities in this world. You can offer these prayers by yourself, individually, in your home, in your office, wherever you are. You don't necessarily have to go to a mosque, but it's encouraged to go to a mosque and take part in congregational prayers, because in Islam, as in Christianity and in other religious traditions as well, there's a great emphasis on fellowship, on camaraderie, on building bonds of friendship through communal worship. And so if one is able to get away, and of course one is encouraged to go to a mosque to offer these prayers and to feel a sense of kinship with one's fellow believers. So if I had to single out one religious activity that's particularly meaningful, I would certainly pick the daily prayers, again, because it reminds us of what our priorities should be about, and also offers these very precious moments of self-reflection and communion with God that I find extremely re-energizing throughout the day. And when I am able to offer these prayers in the mosque, then there is that added dimension of taking part in communal worship and forging stronger bonds of fellowship.
Do you have a favorite prayer?
Do I have a favorite prayer?
Yeah.
Well, all the prayers are actually deemed to be equal. We pray five times a day, which means in the morning, during the dawn period, before sunrise, and then again in the early afternoon, late afternoon, right after sunset, and then at night when it has become fully dark. Well, perhaps the dawn prayer. Because when you get up that early, everything is very quiet around you. It's still dark. It is particularly, it's a particularly spiritual time of the day with very few distractions. You've just gotten up, so your mind is not clouded with, you know, concerns that may have come up during the day. I would think that if I were to pick out just one time of prayer that would be my favorite, I would say that would be it.
Thank you. While we still have a moment, you shared that anecdote before about the king who was humbled by a little righteous knowledge and apologized for misspeaking.
Yes.
To the
although he
woman.
Was not a king, I should tell you, he was just a ruler. Kingship did not enter. Yeah, kingship did not enter Islamic history till much later, and it's actually looked down on because it's dynastic rule, and it does not respect the principle of conferring, consulting with the members of the community.
And that's very interesting because, you know, recently there was an apology made in Denmark. The Politiken newspaper, which reprinted the famous Mohammed cartoons that were offensive to Muslims worldwide, after years of struggling and conflict, owned up and met with the attorney of the descendants of Mohammed. And I didn't know that either, that there were some 95,000 descendants.
Well, actually,
around the
you know,
world
I
and offered an apology for hurting feelings and mm-hmm. and doing something that was offensive, and there's a
right.
lovely photo of them in the paper with you know, shaking hands and warm smiles, mm-hmm. and it drew a lot of criticism on the side of freedom of speech. But I personally, looking at the smiles, felt somewhat
mm-hmm.
differently about it, and I was wondering if you had a thought before we close today on what this takes, this struggle, as we talked about earlier, the struggle to do the right thing
right.
and be a good person in the world.
Right. By the way, I should say I found that passage in the Quran which talks about complete equality of gender. If I can just quickly give that.
Go ahead.
In chapter 33, verse 35, and it states very clearly, those who fear God among males and females, those who give in charity among males and females, those who fast among males and females, those who remember God often among males and females, God has prepared for them forgiveness and great reward. End of quote.
Mm-hmm.
It very clearly underscores that there's no difference in terms of gender. Turning to the Danish cartoons, you know, I actually went back and looked at that newspaper account, and I found out that those people who were critical were mostly drawn from right-wing circles. Like the Danish People's Party was very critical of that, but then, you know, that's a very right-wing extremist nativist party that's opposed to immigration, opposed to, you know, genuine religious plurality in Danish society. So I wouldn't put much stock in those criticisms. I think what's encouraging, and I agree with you there, is the fact that through dialogue and through one-on-one encounters with one another, we can dispel a number of the stereotypes we have about the other, and that we can challenge these notions of exclusivism, that somehow if I want to stake my place in society, it has to be at the expense of someone else.
Mm.
And our discourses about one another, our conversations with one another, must be based on self-respect. People forget that the Danish newspaper, which originally published the cartoons, the Jyllands-Posten, had
yeah.
turned down cartoons that caricatured and ridiculed Jesus Christ. And I actually agree with that decision because they did not want to give offense to Christian religious sensibilities. And therefore, it's very hypocritical when they dredge up the excuse of freedom of expression.
Yes.
In the case of Muslims alone, if you're going to respect the religious sensibilities, and I think that should be the case of a certain group of people, then that must be extended to all religious groups.
Yes.
And I don't think hate speech should be encouraged by any means, regardless of who, which group that hate speech is directed against. And these cartoons were a form of hate speech. And again, if you're going to show consideration for one religious group's feelings, then that should be extended across the board to everybody. And so
yeah.
I think it was a hypocritical stance that they maintained. And I'm very glad to see that there are positive signs of rapprochement and an effort to create a dialogue among different groups of people who may have different perspectives on this issue. And I think freedom of expression is a very important value. But how that plays out and how that gets interpreted, you know, requires the input of many different groups of people. And people's sensibilities should be taken into consideration.
Yes, and humanity should be a factor therein. I think the way forward is to realize that, you know, other people's families are our own.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we must stop drawing these lines in the sand that, you know, it's always us versus them. I think the us has to become far more inclusive. And I think that's the experiment that is now going on in European countries in particular. America, by its very nature, is far more pluralistic and far more receptive of different groups of people and different perspectives and so forth. Europeans really have to start coming out of that kind of exclusive understanding of what it means to be European and expand the definition to include many different groups of people who are contributing to these societies. A number of these groups, for example, in Germany, German citizens of Turkish background for the longest time couldn't get German citizenship because they were not considered to be properly German because they're Muslims and they're Turkish mm-hmm. and considered a threat to the overall European identity of Germans.
Mm.
But now that has changed. So I think people's attitudes can change, and they can change only through having these interfaith encounters and conversations and dialogues and making a concerted effort to open up these doors, to reach out to the other. I mean, I don't think that's too idealistic to say that. We already
see signs of that.
We already see signs of that occurring and the very positive changes that are resulting from that. And one example is, as you pointed out, this reconciliation among, those who were highly critical of the decision of this one paper. I think it was Politiken, you said, to republish the cartoons, the editor and a group of Muslims.
Yes.
So I think that's very encouraging.
Yes, it is. Doctor, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. There's so much to discuss. Perhaps we can speak again in the future.
Okay, I will look forward to that.
And I want to thank our audience for joining us for Godspeed today. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. Our guest was Dr. Asma Afsaruddin, scholar of Islam and author of the book The First Muslims, History and Memory, available at Amazon.com. For more information, please visit GodspeedInstitute.com. We'll be back next Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time for another spiritual journey. Until then, Godspeed.